Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Billington, and tonight I'm joined by Timo Albers-Daly to review the Chinese Grand Prix. How are you, and how did you find the Grand Prix?
You can say I'm pretty good despite watching the Chinese Grand Prix. It was not a good weekend for enjoying a Grand Prix, unless the Grand Prix was anything except the F1 Grand Prix, the F1 Academy. I enjoyed IndyCar, the bits you could watch. I enjoyed the NASCAR. I enjoyed the F1. I'm just glad I was already awake, and rather awake, otherwise it would have been a struggle to stay awake for the duration of that, because not much of anything really happened, and then the stuff that happened afterward didn't help it. How are you?
I'd say about the same. I had a busy weekend. I'd been working away in Birmingham at the NEC for the classic practical classic car restoration show, so busy weekend for me, and managed to squeeze in the Formula One alongside it, especially with the sprint race too, then watched F1 Academy sort of at a later point. But yeah, it's sort of one of those interesting weekends where so much has happened and somehow none of it actually on track when it comes to Formula One seemingly.
It's always a curious weekend where the sprint is more entertaining than the Grand Prix, and the sprint itself was at best.
Yeah, not a great deal of action for the sprint, you could say. There was stuff that happened. It wasn't action packed, to say the least.
There was potential in it more so than we've had in the majority of the sprint races, but at the same and there was some action further down the field, but at the same time it still was not a brilliant advertisement for why it should exist in its current format or any of the previous formats that we've had for it. So it was a very odd topsy-turvy weekend, but that just seems to be from more in 2025. It's all just a bit of a mess in a different way so far, and no one quite knows what to do with it.
I think if F1 Academy proved anything, it's that we should bring reverse grids back, or bring reverse grids rather into Formula One for the sprint race.
It's the one format they've not tried, and I don't know why they haven't. I've been debating this with numerous people over the weekend, and everyone is thinking the same thing, and you're going, well, come on then. You're trying everything else that no one even thought of or asked for, so why not go for the one that was already in place in all the categories to begin with? Crazy idea, I know.
Yeah, crazy idea. Anyway, we'll jump into a little bit of news before we get into our race review. And obviously, we have to start with the sad news of the passing of Eddie Jordan, the Formula One icon, a team owner through Formula 3, coming to the Junior Series, and made his way up into Formula One with Jordan Race Team. Famously claims that he was the guy who discovered Michael Schumacher, and a variety of sort of highs and lows followed his team throughout. And obviously, it's a team that's technically still lives on. Its DNA lives on in Aston Martin to this day. So he's a man who's had a long-lasting impact on the sport, and one that I would argue continually changed the sport for the better. And I know that certainly in the world of Formula One, his the loss of his presence will be felt sorely.
Yeah, it's an interesting weekend for it to have happened, which I'll touch on later, but it was nice to see Aston Martin straight away with the little tribute on the car. But personally, quite like to see tribute liveries for every team in Suzuka, and then again at Spa. I think there's enough iconic Jordan liveries from over the many, many seasons and the many deals that he made that would be well worth doing it. And if ever there was a time to bring a splash of yellow or complete yellow back to any one of the teams, now would be the time. I can picture the Aston Martin in the 7-Up Jordan livery, and then you just divvy out the rest of them between themselves, because at that point, why wouldn't you? It would just be a really nice way of doing it. Very well, it's kind of the only way you can do that sort of thing in motorsports. Everyone's got their own way of honouring that person, and liveries is F1's way of doing it, I think. And a sticker is nice, but a livery is better and more fitting for someone as titanic as him.
Yeah, I think obviously the last minute nature of it sort of emerging, you can't fly out an entirely new set of body panels and liveries for one race, but with a 2-week head start on Suzuka, maybe they'll have something in place for it. I would like to see the yellow Buzzin' Hornets livery potentially make a return as well. I think that was quite fun. And obviously, because it's Buzzin' Hornets sponsored, it does not contravene their rules about advertising tobacco. Are you also wearing a yellow jumper like I am as well in sort of a...
Unfortunately, yes, we have clashed on this one. It was not intentional, and I'm going to claim it's purely Eddie Jordan, but that's just a happy accident at this point.
I feel we ought to just sort of write it out as an Eddie Jordan tribute, but there we go. It's a Sad loss, and obviously I know that a great many people within the sport will be mourning his absence moving forwards, because he was obviously still a pundit, still a podcaster, still had sort of a great show when it came to sort of popularizing and producing Formula One in its modern format.
We are still turned up on Channel 4 occasionally and had a weekly sit down chin wag podcast with Coulthard. And yeah, it was interesting to see because it doesn't happen too often. It's a shame it happens only when someone of his magnitude passes away. But one of the few times everyone in the sport was on the same side for something. You saw Flavio Briatore agreeing with people. You saw Zak Brown and Christian Horner actually, maybe not quite hugging and shaking hands, that sort of thing, but kind of agreeing on the fact that it was a damn shame that Eddie had died. And yeah, it just shows you the scale of it. And F1 came out with a really nice tribute that Alex Chase narrated. I don't know if you saw that, but again, the speed and quality with which they turned that around, Channel 4 did the same thing. Sky Sports managed to actually produce some good content, which it's been a while since they've done that as for like a pre-race or a post-race thing that isn't live. So it just shows you're all very capable of doing it. And I don't know why they're not the rest of the time, but I'm hoping that, well, I'm glad rather that they were able to do it for this.
Yeah, there was a great piece produced by Bono as well, which was absolutely incredible.
Helpful.
I really enjoyed that one, but there we go. We'll move from obviously Eddie's sad passing to the Chinese Grand Prix itself. Obviously, we've already mentioned it was a sprint weekend, which didn't hugely impact things, but we did, of course, see Lewis Hamilton's first win of sorts in red. A bit of interesting digging reveals just how much the FIA and the hierarchy thinks about sprints, in that while, yes, you earn points for your championship in it, they don't count as a race. So when it comes to drivers that are tied on points in countback, the sprint order, the sprint finishing order has no bearing on that. So it's weird that we have this event that has so little bearing on a championship. Obviously, it has points, but if you're tied, you cannot say that, oh yeah, but I won that sprint, so that gives me a win over you. Unfortunately, it does not work like that. That was an interesting little fact that I found when I was going through and doing my sheets and my data and my charts this weekend.
This makes you question why the hell they got it there in the first place, even more, doesn't it?
Yeah, I thought you would appreciate that fact, given your sentiments towards the sprint. It's sort of another log of.
It's not helped when they make my argument for me. I don't even need to do anything at that point. I just sit there going, come on, guys.
Yeah,
Really?
I just felt you'd appreciate knowing they are building a rod for their own back of sorts. But with that out of the way, we might as well jump in. We'll go team by team, ordered in Constructors' Championship order as it stands. So that'll be why the order seems a bit doolally at the moment, because that's just simply how the championship is. But we kick off with McLaren, a second win in a row. Well, third win, technically, because of course they racked up several in the tail end of last season. But this season, two in a row. Piastri started from pole, Norris qualified third, and Piastri would go on to take his maiden win of the season, with Norris finishing just behind him. McLaren's 50th 1-2 result in the sport. Very nice work.
Clinical execution from Piastri during the Grand Prix did not put a foot wrong. And after last weekend, I won't say redemption because he didn't have to anything to redeem himself for. It was just sheer dumb luck, but exactly what he needed to course correct. And you'll love to see it. And the Australians would definitely be very happy about it and just wishing that it could have been maybe the other way around, given the bad luck Australian drivers have on home turf. Norris, on the other hand, he was very lucky that there was not an extra Grand Prix lap, otherwise P2 would have been lost to George Russell. And Russell's probably wishing he pushed a little bit sooner because he wasn't quite Alex Palou in Thermal Grand Prix in terms of getting that gap closed down, but he wasn't a million miles away either in terms of just the rate of knots at which he was closing that gap down. Norris, though, don't know, it was good that he was able to keep hold of P2 and ride that bit out for the team, and it's good for the constructors. But all weekend, he looked untidy and a bit scruffy. Lots of errors in T14. Sprint qualifying, he messed that up. And then in the sprint itself, he took 18 laps of the 19 to get past Lance Stroll. And that's just balmy. I mean, it's bad for him and it's great for everyone else because it means we get to watch this interesting dynamic and it keeps the championship interesting immediately in race two. But just what a change in attitude. You saw how he was speaking off track as well. It was very different to last week, and you were thinking, oh, he's turned a corner. Good for him. He's getting his head in the game. And then 1 week later, he's not many miles away, but it just everything seemed to change demeanor. And you're going, what happened here? And you think if you're kind of glad for him in some respects that he didn't get P3. Otherwise, blimey, what would you be talking to him? How would he be talking afterwards? And it's just, I mean, as we see with many teams, what a difference a week can make.
Yeah, it's a bit of a turnaround when it comes to sort of certain aspects of it. But it's, yeah, I think the on-track pace advantage is still very strong for McLaren. And yeah, that brake issue Lando suffered showed there's still some issues to be teased out. I think obviously these are incredibly complex mechanical things. There are going to always be a few problems. But by and large, they've nailed down that sort of technical package. Norris's start was mega, and the immediate aggression was what I really wanted to see from him as well. There's been this sort of certainly a step up in his driving approach. His work on Russell through the opening sector was spot on, and he put pressure on Oscar from the off. He didn't make it easy for Oscar, but obviously, eventually, I think McLaren must have at some point on broadcast radio go 1-2's good for us on the championship. Lando, you're still going to be leading. It's all fair and game. Yeah, dirty on the big straights though. Obviously, we saw Norris drop back against Piastri in the main race, but I think that was also what was hampering him a bit when he was trying to come past Stroll in the sprint. Just that huge long straight out the back. Even if you get a good driver for what is it, turn 12, 13 at China, it is a 1 kilometer straight or something ridiculous like that.
1.2 kilometers, yeah.
So that is a long way to be sat in dirty air. And no matter how good you can make your technical package, it's never going to be great when it comes to non-uniform sort of airflow. It's so, I think.
Well, you need to do what Piastri did for Verstappen, or you need to do what certain drivers did then into that corner at the end and just absolutely launch it Daniel Ricciardo style from about 6 miles back and just commit. And most of the time that'll work.
Yeah, a bit of commitment, a big sort of send on the brakes did seem to work and did seem to be working both in Formula One and the Academy Series as well. Another option is try and get a run through that final turn, which would be what, turn 15 onto the start finish straight. Obviously, it can be done. You can absolutely throw a car through there, especially towards the end of the race when you're light on fuel and maybe still have a bit of grip in your tyres. You could properly send it through there. We saw George Russell doing exactly that in qualifying, where he made a brilliant run to the line, qualified P2, and was upshifting through that corner. Not something you always see, but that car seemed relatively stable under us. There's scope for this sort of additional push as teams sort of understand the cars a bit more. But it's overall it's good seeing this sort of development from McLaren, this learning, the fact they are willing to rest on their laurels so far. They're going to keep pushing a little bit more and a little bit more each weekend. And the driver seems to be in the right place to sort of use that and learn from that. We've already mentioned George Russell, so we'll touch on Mercedes, who are second on the sort of championship standings. Qualified second, finished third, and Antonelli qualified eighth, finished P6. I think Antonelli's result there isn't hugely indicative of his efforts across the race. Steady, clean, tidy. Kimi is still learning a bit, scrapped through his field after his pit stops. But I think ultimately that P6 is quite fortuitous, obviously, with the Ferrari disqualification, who we will get to in due course. But Russell's race, again, really good. He understands the chassis, he's leading the team from the front, and it's very competitive. His consistency will pay dividends as the season develops, I think.
Yeah, Mercedes are being Ferrari from last year in their dark horse potential. And like you say, Russell with a superb drive all weekend. He, a little bit like the team, reminds me of Leclerc from last year, just learning from his previous seasons, putting it all together and going off after everyone else and going, I don't know if I'm in with a shout of it, but I'll be damned if I don't give it a try and just kind of quietly have these anonymous races where there's not too much attention on me, but that's perfectly fine. And yeah, a good quiet weekend for Antonelli too. I mean, even if the Ferrari stayed there, that's eighth, finishes eighth, would have been perfectly fine, gets solid points for the team in his second race for a big team like Mercedes. You wouldn't be having any complaints if you're Toto Wolff.
Yeah, overall, it's a good result from him. It was clean, tidy. It wasn't expensive. Didn't bin it, didn't wreck it. So it's exactly the drive you really want from Antonelli. And obviously, he's still learning a huge amount. And I mean, he's not that far adrift of the leading pack. Norris is on 44 points, Verstappen 36, Russell 35, Piastri 34, very tight at the top. And then there's a bit of a gap to Antonelli on 22. But a race win will come for him this season, almost certainly, and that will help keep him close to the field around him. And again, if he stays this consistent, I don't see why it won't happen. Still a bit baffled by driver of the day for him. Unclear.
think everyone is, including Antonella.
His radio message about it was equally as confused. But there we go. There were certainly other drivers that may have earned that a bit more. Third place in constructors is Red Bull. Verstappen qualified fourth, while Lawson qualified P20 and ended up with a pit lane start. Verstappen comes home P4 and Lawson 12th.
Do this now or later?
We'll do this now, and I think when we get back to it, I'll just simply sort of add a summative point. I don't think I'll go through it twice, but I feel it's worth doing it now. Let's get it out of the way. Rip the band-aid off.
I'll start with Verstappen because that's the easy part. Damage limitation from him across the board, really. He seems quite happy inside the car and out, despite it lacking in performance. He just seems pretty content with everything in life, which is nice to see from a driver where this has historically not often been the case. I think he just knows that he doesn't have anything to prove anymore. He's won four championships in four different manners. He's going to be a dad soon. He doesn't really, he's just happy. He's kind of just playing the team game really well in terms of how he's acting, what he's saying to keep everyone reassured and content, both on and off the grid and back at the factory. And a little bit like Hulk in Oz, he just got on and drove and did the best that he could, and he isn't throwing his toys out of the pram if it doesn't go his way. So it's kind of him channeling his Sebastian Vettel from when Vettel went to Ferrari and Aston Martin, but without having to leave Red Bull in order to do it, which is just curious to see.
I'll interject as we're talking about Max Verstappen, and certainly while we're talking about Red Bull at this point, I will agree with you. I think it was a really interesting and unique drive from Max, and it's one showing the level of maturity he's attained over the past few seasons and his sort of understanding as to what he's achieved, what he's earned, and that he can now just sort of revel in his victory and know that even at the moment he's still second in the championship. It's not all done for. We're two races in, there's still a lot to go.
He's in the third or fourth best car, and he's 8 points off the lead of the championship. And as much as he was joking with Rachel Foote prior to the Grand Prix that the only way you can win is if the two cars ahead of him DNF, or three rather, if you can move Russell. If Russell's there by himself, game on. Because I'd say that that driver in that Red Bull against the complete package or more complete package that Russell and Mercedes are, it's still pretty even on that one. And a bit like Antonelli probably winning a race at some point this year, it only needs a situation like that where McLaren are just suddenly on the back foot for whatever reason, or just not there for that to be possible. And at that point, he could sneak ahead and be in the lead for a championship for a little bit, which, even if it doesn't last, it just helps to play mind games with everyone else around you because you go, how the hell is he still doing this? He's already done it to you once, Norris, don't let him do it again.
Yeah, I think there is every reason that Max will win a race this season. I think that's even in even less doubt than Antonelli winning one. And yeah, his performance, the way he's working with the team, the way he's sort of looking at developmental bits, looking at sort of stepping up and sort of being more of a sort of a team player as opposed to just having his own team within Red Bull. He's becoming sort of, or openly people are sort of speaking about him being more part and parcel of the unit, which is really interesting because Verstappen, who's always been Max Verstappen, he arrives on a Sunday, he races and goes away again. And we're seeing this sort of slightly new character that this season's drawing out to him, which is really quite interesting and sort of a positive shift for Red Bull. Meanwhile, I will let you open on the other half of the Red Bull garage.
You're gonna have to bear with me for a moment because there's a lot here, and I just want to do it once, do it properly, because I'm so grumpy, I'm bored shitless already of having to do this every day. So I'd rather just get everything out, and then I can just say in future episodes, refer back to this timestamp on this episode, and I'll let you know if anything changes on my opinion. So with that in mind, my monologue will start now. We'll go back in time a little bit, as the infamous interviewer once started. Ricardo, he spent 2 years at Toro Rosso before moving up to Red Bull. And after Ricardo left, which he did after 5 years at the team, Red Bull went through Daniil Kvyat, Pierre Gasly, and Alex Albon before settling with a driver outside of their junior program, Sergio Perez, who partnered Max Verstappen. Kvyat was given a season and a half at Red Bull. Gasly was given half a season. Albon was given a season and a half. And midway through 2022, Perez began to drop off in performance. It's measurable up until the inevitable departure. Yuki at that point had only scored 12 points in that year and only 17 the following year, which is hardly good enough to deserve a promotion at that point. during their respective times in Toro Rosso, Fiat and Gasly had a number of points. I mean, you look at Fiat, he was the weakest one, but he got points of 37 and 32 in his last 2 years in Canada. Gasly, he went from 29 to 75 to 110 to 23, but that was a good year for him. And I think he was already also driving with one foot out the door, as it were. And during Gasly's time at the junior team, he only finished outside of the top 10 five times, which includes two DNFs. Albon obviously had about 12 races with Toro Rosso before he made the jump up to Red Bull. He scored 92 points, 105 respectively. And during his time at Red Bull, he only finished outside the top 10 six times, which does include DNF, not counting Austria, because he was still classified there. Perez finished outside the top 20, sorry, finished outside the top 10. That would have been impressive even for him. 20 times during his stint at Red Bull, but that includes 10 retirements. So not too bad on the face of it when you look there, because again, these things could be mechanical, could be someone else taking you out. You're probably not taking yourself out in the majority of these sorts of situations. Ricciardo, meanwhile, he finished outside the top 10 24 times, but 18 of those were DNFs, which is just a fun kind of statistic to throw in there. In 2014 and 2016 combined, of the races that Ricciardo finished, he only finished outside the top 10 once, and it was a P11. In 2018, he only finished outside the top 10 because he DNF'd. The rest of the time, he was in the top 10. So that's the history and expectation that Tsunoda and Lawson are going up against here. So despite qualifying well, because we know he can do it, Tsunoda's only been able to finish fourth once and sixth once, both in 2021. All the other points he scored in his F1 career have been below that. Gasly at that team, he won the Italian Grand Prix and he got on the podium in Baku. Kvyat got on the podium in Germany. Albon never got the chance because he got promoted so damn quickly, but he did finish in the top 10 five times whilst he was at the junior team, and he was just outside the points three times, I think P11 and P12, before he was promoted in his rookie season. Last year was obviously Tsunoda's strongest season since 2021, but in 2023, when Lawson came in for the five Grand Prix, he beat Tsunoda in four of them and scored points in Singapore in a crazy good race for him. Last year, he beat Tsunoda in two Grand Prix and was evenly matched in Qatar. I think they were one position apart from each other. And that was after having been out of the car for over a year at that point, while Tsunoda had been racing in the same car in the entire interim. Lawson did all this without time in a Red Bull car, because as much as we always go on about how there's the obvious linkage there, they are two fundamentally different cars, and they kind of make a very clear point of that. I mean, you go back to testing, I can't remember who the technical director is, but there was an interview with him going, "We've changed this a lot from last year, never mind from the Red Bull." So it's very different this year. And post Chinese Grand Prix, Bernie Ecclestone made an interesting point, which I wanted to latch onto, which was why are Red Bull not following Mercedes' example with Antonelli in terms of the time that they're giving him? Why not put Lawson in an old Red Bull car, not controlled by the cross cab, and work him to the bone, take him to track, throw him around, just do everything you need to do there? Because they've done that with Antonelli at Mercedes, and it's clearly worked. They did it with Lewis, I believe, back when he was at McLaren for the first time. He knew that car obviously well, and guess what? It worked. I don't know why they're not doing that, especially when Verstappen even admits that it's a tricky car to drive, and when the four-time world champion says it's tricky to drive, you probably should believe him. Tsunoda's qualified fifth and ninth so far this season, but he's failed to score points on either occasion. And in China, Lawson and Hadjar did both finish ahead of him. I know neither of them scored points, but if we're going to look at results, and a lot of people are going to look at just results, then it matters. So while the argument can be made that Minardi, because it's the base word we all know we can associate with the call that team, is good experience, it's a very different car. The Red Bull in this year's Racing Bulls, as I've said already, is very different to last year's. And it's something where I was interested to see that Ricciardo's test, I was going back in the Red Bull in Silverstone versus his performance in the Minardi, just shows how different they are. And it would have been really interesting if he'd been put in that Red Bull instead of Perez for half a season instead of in the Racing Bulls, because I think we might have had a whole completely different outcome there. But that's a what if podcast for another day. I'm not going to insist on bringing Ricciardo back at this point. It just highlights why being good in one doesn't mean you'll be good in the other. And I just think two Grand Prix is not enough time to get up to speed with a new team. Because if that were the case, then should we cast out Behrmann, Bortoleto, Hadjar, Sainz, and Ocon and Hülkenberg because they've all had mixed results in their first two Grand Prix at a new team. Be stupid. So it makes a lot of sense to me why Red Bull chose Lawson, and they should stick to their guns, keep him for the season, because you need a full data set. You get tracks where they've been before, tracks where they haven't, and you get a really interesting map layout. And one of the things I really liked about James Bowers was that, and still do, it's not gone anywhere else, with Logan Sargeant, was they gave him plenty of time, arguably a lot more than other people would have given him, to figure out if there could be an improvement there. I think the argument can be made that Williams has time on their side to afford to do that kind of thing because they're not fighting for a championship. But at the same time, you look at the expectations that I said about earlier with all the previous drivers that have been in Toro Rosso and Red Bull. You need to be sure that you can give that kind of a level. And when you've not been in that car, it's a lot easier to say than it is to actually do. And when Lawson's coming in for small periods of time over 2 years without any other training in the car in the meantime, and he's on the same level and sometimes beating you when you've been there for 4 years, I can understand why you get chosen over the guy that's been there for the 4 years, and why you are going to obviously be comfortable in the team that you're entering your fifth season with when you just know it so damn well. It's kind of like, I'm suspicious to why Lando's so good in McLaren or Charles is so good in Ferrari. Is it because they've been there for donkey's years? Probably helps and something to do with it. So, like I said, it makes a lot of sense to me why Red Bull chose Lawson and why they should keep him there and give him a fighting chance. They only have themselves to blame otherwise for not giving him more time in the car. They could have just done with the my point, Bernie's point about getting in the car. And instead, if they don't kind of do that and they keep going through the cycle, then they end up back in the Perez situation in the first place, which, granted, he was a massively experienced driver that still struggled in the end. And then you've got an exhausted and broken driver program that previously took years to heal. And I just think that in a week where Eddie Jordan passed away, and who loved and was famous for giving new drivers a chance and advocating for there being more on the grid, especially last year, he was quite vocal about it because there were none. It doesn't come across as treating rookies particularly great like this, and we've got the same problem with Doohan, and we'll get to him later. And I just think if you put Yuki in that car, a Suzuka for a one-off, which is just silly anyway, it's like, what do you do afterwards? You swap them back again. What are you actually going to hope to achieve here? What do, if he doesn't perform, if he doesn't get minimum 10th, what does that do for him? Is that is he's just essentially buggered immediately. He's done. And what do we do then? We've got to rush Lindblad in into that racing board. We've got to poach Colapinto from somewhere with this random ass rumor that's come out of nowhere. Then Ollie Gurth is suddenly waking up going, oh Christ, I'm nearly up for this in a minute because Lindblad's gone. And then you're in the same situation again. You just go, you not learn anything. Why would you not just take this time now? Verstappen's saying it's a tricky car, develop it. And he said as well, develop the car towards the other drivers and not just me. I can work with this. And I think he genuinely means this one because, like we talked about just now, he doesn't have anything to prove at this point. He's quite content with how things are. He could leave at any time and he doesn't. And we'd all be like, he's still one of the greatest there's been because look at what he's achieved. He's got nothing to prove. So why not just keep Lawson, actually develop a driver for more than 5 minutes before throwing someone else in the car and expecting it to work? None of the other teams do this to this level. And I just wonder after what Ricciardo left in 2018, I think, around that time, 2018, 2019, that sort of period, you think the intervening time within that, they appear to have learned the square root of not that much when it comes to developing junior drivers. So stick with Lawson, stick to what you know, stick to your guns. You promoted him for a reason. Yes, it's not been a great couple of weekends for him, but that's not a reason to bin him off. And you kind of go, well, if we judged everyone by how they start a season, teams, drivers alike, and we then ignore the rest of the season, you'd be ignoring how well McLaren did at the end of last year. You go, well, that's just a silly way of measuring something, isn't it?
And this is the thing that I overwhelmingly agree with you on the 98% of what you've said. And this is the thing, it's tricky for us to have a discussion because what you said is exactly sort of what I feel. And logically, The argument for Red Bull to stop dicking around makes a huge amount of sense. They've proven nothing by doing this. Well, actually, they've proven something, and it's that it does not give drivers a chance to develop, to get their feet under the table, and to actually prove things. I think that it is worth bearing in mind that the competitiveness of that Minardi Toro Rosso, I think Fernando Alonso called it Toro Rosso at one point across the weekend, that Toro Rosso has been hugely unreliable to try and sort of pin down its sort of competitiveness against the rest of the field. Some seasons it has been like a sort of pure P5 in the championship all day long sort of car, and some years it has been sort of a proper sort of P9 or P8er. So it is tricky to sort of, certainly over the past few years, give an accurate metric on that, which doesn't help things. But binning off Lawson after two races is by no means an improvement off simply guesswork. And he deserves the time in the seat to get his feet under the table and to sort of prove himself and to get used to that car. Red Bull don't build cars for a driver. This is one of the crucial things. No team goes out there and builds a car for a driver. You have two drivers for a reason. You build a car. It is then up to your drivers to learn how to drive that car. The difference with Red Bull is the fact that Max is an incredibly adaptable driver. You've only got to have a look back at that time for a showcase series of runs. He jumped in, I think it was like a Honda IMSA car, the time that he jumped into a GT3 sports car and was racking up lap times and speed immensely quickly. He is a driver that has an uncanny ability to get in any car and drive it incredibly flat out, because he can just adapt to the way that a car drives, a car handles, and how to turn lap time from a car. We've seen the same with drivers like Shane Van Gisbergen when he moved from Aussie Supercars to NASCAR, is what he's in at the moment. And if you watch British Touring Cars and follow anything Jake Hill does, you'll know that he is exactly the same. You can chuck Jake Hill at a car. If you watch him at Goodwood Members Meeting, Festival of Speed, or Revival, he has been thrown at all manner of cars and is perfectly capable of turning an incredible lap time out of something so far removed from what he last drove. So Goodwood, he's usually in some hyper powerful rear wheel drive 1960 sports coupe. Festival of Speed, they chucked him into a shadow car from the old Can-Am series. He can get in anything and turn lap time. That is one of the key definers of a sort of top tier driver. Lewis Hamilton has very much that same ability to put him into a car and away he goes. He is immediately on it. He's immediately able to pin down what makes it quick. Sebastian Vettel, very similar in that ability to get in a car and extract lap time. So this is where we have this idea of, well, every car must have been built for Max Verstappen because he's able to go quickly. No, Max Verstappen is able to go quickly in any car. And the problem is that then starts to mask issues. That's where it starts to bite drivers like Sergio Perez, like Alex Albon, and like we've already started seeing this season, Liam Lawson. So to sort of think that blinkeredly about it, and this isn't an accusation at you, this is an accusation at Red Bull, to think that blinkeredly about it is ridiculous. And you would think that a racing team that is as competent, seemingly, as Red Bull, they would be able to piece that together. Surely they know Max Verstappen well enough as a driver. They've had in that seat since 2016, nearly a decade in that seat. And the amount of press things they've done where they've thrown him in cars where he's proven to be immensely quickly, show runs, this, that, the other, where he's able to simply get in and go. He is a man who eats, sleeps, and breathes motorsport and racing. Look at him when he's doing his sim racing with Gabby Bortoleto. Like the fact that he can just do anything and be quick. While it is great to have that as a team, the problem is trying to find someone who can match that when you don't have a perfect car becomes a stumbling block. That's where the problem arises.
Especially when you don't prepare them for it, which is why I think
Yes.
if you want to put Yuki or Hadjar, for argument's sake, in that Red Bull seat, you don't do it this season. You spend this season with Lawson in there, so you have data, and then you do what I suggested you should have done for Lawson and what Bernie suggested you should have done for Hadjar and for Tsunoda. In the meantime, in the summer break, you throw them in there and
The
you get them
closest
up to speed.
equivalent old
So
chef.
that you can get as close you can get, so then you actually can measure them all, and off and away we go. Then the justification for which way or the other actually makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, I can't remember what the numbers were for what Antonelli racked up in testing previous cars.
10,000K or something
It
stupid.
was something absurd, and he was doing it at a multitude of different circuits to get a feel for how the car happens at a flat and fast Barcelona for a twisty and tight Red Bull ring. He was all over the shop. That's Mercedes got a private test at the Red Bull ring. That is the dedication that you've got to sort of extrapolate from what Mercedes were doing with Antonelli and apply that to what Red Bull should be
Hell,
doing
you
with
even look at the small amount that Ferrari gave to Lewis at
Red Bull.
Fiorano and at Barcelona just to help him a little bit, and that's the 7-time champ coming in, never mind a rookie. And you see how much he's still trying to figure things out there. Just makes you go, but if that's what you're doing for this guy, the arguably greatest of all time, who in that car with that liveries, particularly the white bits, keeps getting me confused with Michael sometimes. Just makes me think why you're not doing it for your young drivers. And the same kind of thing for Alpine. It's you're looking there, you've got these drivers, but how are you going to measure this? You think if you, well, now we're getting to Alpine here, but whilst we're here, do you think you could throw out Doohan and just put in Colapinto into and it's going to be fixed? That's not how that works. You've got to actually develop these drivers. That's why they're called development drivers, test drivers. You can't just go, well, if you did well in Formula 2, you'll be fine here. Yeah, it helps. But it's not a guarantee of anything, and you need to do common sense things like put them in a car and get them around the place. It's why I was kind of intrigued when I was thinking back all over it about Ricciardo and Red Bull, how different that could have been. Because, yeah, it was the same car, it was the car that he was in for 5 seasons, and it's the one he's most used to. And you throw him in a car that's okay, media wise, very similar, but that's not how that works, and then wonder why he's not performing as well. It's just, and okay, admittedly, these cars weren't best for his style of driving anyway. But again, when you're looking for the next Max Verstappen or the next Lewis Hamilton or the next Oscar Piastri, you're going to get through so many people because you're not going to have that natural thing and you're not willing to develop that. And even those drivers will still need time to develop. Verstappen wasn't perfect from the get-go. He was pretty damn good. But, you know, even he will admit that he is a much better driver now than he ever was back then. And that comes through development.
And Red Bull has no excuse for this. They have, for when it comes to testing previous cars that don't fall under the cost cap budget, they have endless reserves of money. Alpine, I can understand it, is a little bit different. It is a smaller team on a slightly more confined budget. And most of what Jack Doohan's testing work has been previously has been sim work, which is great. But when they're running off of
But
a.
there's no thing for the real thing.
There is no substitution for the actual thing. But so for Red Bull to have not done this shows that either they don't care or they are for some reason so bloody mindedly sticking to this idea that Max Verstappen can win the championship with single-handedly, which baffles me. And yeah, my notes that I've written out for Lawson is with a bit of luck, Suzuka, a track he knows well, should do him some favors. And I genuinely want him to do well. And every time I've got criticism or comment on him, I don't want people to think this is just me slamming the keyboard at Liam Lawson. This is the mistreatment of him by Red Bull, and it is a pattern we are seeing repeated. But at the same time, he had a stonker of a quali lap in Singapore in an RB in 2023. He has this incredible raw talent. It's just not being nurtured appropriately. And I don't know at what point we start making
That's the
excuses.
thing, it was the RB, it wasn't the Red Bull.
It was possibly
Different car.
a more approachable car, one he might have been more familiar with, one that might be more suited to his driving style, so required less of that adaptation. There's all manner of things that we don't know because we are neither an engineer for RB or Red Bull, and we are not Liam Lawson. And until we become those three people, we won't really know the answer. Until those three people write a tell-all book, we won't know. So there's a lot of things to piece together. Are we likely to see him swap with Yuki for Japan? As much as the internet seemed to think so, and while I was the only person that predicted they would have to do this season, this was down to the way I think Red Bull treats their drivers. And an engineer at Red Bull has come forward and said, if they're swapping Liam and Yuki, they ought to tell us sometime soon because we haven't made up a steering wheel for Yuki yet. And this is one of the crucial things people forget is you can't just do it like that. You can't just put them in. The amount of work that Lewis Hamilton and Ferrari put together to get his cockpit and his steering wheel set up ahead of the season was immense. And we're talking hundreds of development hours. So Ferrari could bring in a steering wheel so Lewis Hamilton could start his races with his hand on the top to stop gear and clutch knockdown, so he can have his brake magic button, so he can have controls and dials in the right place, so he can also learn the control patterns for that wheel. There'll possibly be a similarity between an RB and a Red Bull, but at the same time, that's a huge amount of development to ask a company to do in the space of a week and a half. And then it's a huge amount to ask Yuki to go, right, get used to it. You've got three practice sessions and then you're into qualifying. Best of luck, sunshine. At least when it came to
That
Oliveira.
surprises me that he doesn't fully realize that or not come across that way in the media, as has been reported. He just seems up for him. Like, well, on the one hand, yeah, I can understand because you've been chasing that seat for a while, but at the same time, surely you must realize that if you aren't on the money immediately, you're going to look so stupid, and you've only got yourself to blame because everyone's going, no, it's a trap. Have you not been watching all of the past seasons where this is clearly a trap? It's a trap door with trap door written on it. Cannot be getting any more obvious.
And at the same time, while that RB is consistently outperforming at least Liam Lawson, you might as well stick there and hope that they eventually learn how to do a strategy and do some race calls and hope the front wing doesn't fall apart. We'll get to RB in due course because there are a lot of problems with that team at the moment as well. But I don't know. I don't think the swap is going to happen. The rumor mill loves to get excited about this, especially because the rumor mill got bored of saying that Colapinto was going to replace Doohan. Then all of a sudden, Colapinto's popped up as potentially being put on loan to Red Bull. That is even more far-fetched. There is a lot of hurdles for Liam Lawson to overcome this season, and I want him to overcome them. He is a good driver. He went to Super
I
Formula
just want him to get the opportunity for it in the same way that Doohan deserves the opportunity for it. It's
Yeah.
regardless of which way it goes, I don't mind if it goes badly for either of them, as long as they're given the
Get a
opportunity
fair
to
shot.
demonstrate it, because it seems bizarre that you could have drivers like Latifi, Mazepin, and Sargeant be there for at least one season, in two of the cases, multiple seasons, and you would have got multiple seasons of Mazepin. Jesus Christ, I'm glad we avoided that. And yet you wouldn't have to get half a season for these two drivers. And you think, considering that both of them have been away from Formula One as such in different ways, admittedly Lawson has seen Formula but still very different, and Doohan's been just kind of hoovering opportunities where he can, the fact that they're even on the pace in the beginning and not 10 seconds away from everyone else just shows how bloody good they both are, and why you should take the you need to develop them for the entire course of the season. And maybe, I don't know, do what we said earlier and chuck them in an old car and just give them some testing days like other people would do, as should be kind of the expectation.
Oh, I don't get me wrong. I 100% agree with you there. And I know if we asked Martin Villari on this, our sort of tame driver coach, and said, what is the one way to improve as a driver? He's going to say seat time. And what do Doohan and Lawson not have compared to some of the others? Seat time. That is the simplest fix, is just.
Exactly. It's the thing with Bortoleto and Hadjar and Behrmann as well, and Antonelli to an extent. Well, regardless of if he'd had them testing the procedures or not, they were all racing in Formula 2 last year. They had this consistent thing there. They had FP1 sessions. Behrmann obviously had some Grand Prix. They have the consistent thing and they keep going. They follow that through. These two, it's kind of like if you throw Felipe Drugovich in there, he's not going to be on it on the go because he's been out of it for a little bit, and it doesn't matter what you're doing elsewhere. If you don't have it consistently enough, it's going to screw you up, and that's what makes Lawson's performances from 23 and 24 with that massive gap between so impressive, because he was just expected to do it and he did. And then, as soon as you've thrown in a different car that's related, you go, oh, what's going on here? And you think, would you be criticizing him the same way if he'd gone into a Ferrari or a McLaren? Probably not. So it's interesting that you suddenly do it when it's the Red Bull,
Yeah, and because
just
Red
because
Bull,
of the linkage.
yeah, and Red Bull's known for doing this sort of thing, and because it has that sister team, it sort of feels that it's obliged to do it. And I think Red Bull's almost sort of gilded itself its own poison chalice, and I don't like what it's done. We'll wrap up talking about them because I think we've mentioned and spoke about Red Bull enough as it is, and I think this is a story that will continue to rumble on. But the BBC's Andrew Benson made a very interesting point earlier, which is given how lowly Red Bull seemingly rate Yuki and how badly they think these moves through, are we likely to see Hadjar moved up to the top team this season instead? Because
It'd be
that's
equally as stupid.
it would be equally as stupid, but at the same time, Yuki,
Wouldn't put it past them.
yeah. I wouldn't put it past them. And equally, if they'd wanted to move Yuki up, they would have put Lawson into that RB for the start of this season. If they wanted to do it,
Well,
they
that's the thing. They
would.
never wanted to move Yuki up.
So it's unlikely that if the opportunity or demand for a swap comes, that they will pick Yuki. I think Andrew makes a very good point there. And again, it's one that perfectly highlights the problem with current Red Bull.
It would then open the door for a repeat of history, but instead of Perez, it'd be Hülkenberg going to Red Bull, and we'd finally see him get to win a few races. So there is a silver lining to that one, because they'd have exhausted all the junior drivers again and go, oh, how did this happen? And everyone's going, really, guys? Really? But also Hulk's home.
Yeah, Hülkenberg podium or win. We'll wait and see. Anyway, that's Red Bull out of the way. We get to P4 in the Constructors' Championship. Have we been recording for nearly 50 minutes and we've only just got to P4? Anyway,
The rest of this will be pretty slim in comparison, I think.
this is the Red Bull podcast with nine other teams included. Williams are in P4, bafflingly. Alex Albon qualified 10th while Sainz qualified 15th, still getting used to the car, but you know what Williams are going to do? They're going to give him time. Albon then goes on to finish P7 and Sainz edges his way into the points. And I have to say, there is a beautiful bit of poetry that Sainz's first points with Williams come at the hands of Ferrari's downfall. There is a little bit of beauty in that I think we can all appreciate with a GCSE in English. Albon's grip on that car, however, is incredible. You can tell he's been working with the team to develop it. He understands it so innately. And science is still learning. Very much a sort of Charles and Lewis sort of affair in the fact that one knows the car, one is still learning. Both are very quick and respected drivers. Albon seems to be in regular points contention, and science was fortunate this weekend. But right place, right time with some unique conditions earned him those points. And we always say, you don't get lucky. You've got to make your own luck. You've got to put yourself in those positions to capitalize on them. And I think it's fair enough to say that he'd done that.
It was his first Grand Prix proper because he really, never really got the chance in Australia. So he knows what he's doing. He puts it there, right place, right time. So even if he isn't in the points, he's near enough to it, which is what Racing Bull should have done with at least one of their cars. We'll get to that later. But just as a counterpoint of the development there, the experience that a driver like Sainz has. And again, Albon, a former Red Bull Junior, look what happens when you give him a bit of time, you develop that driver. He's coming alive out of that team, and it's a joy to watch. He was happy enough with the P8 he originally got, and then the fact he gets P6, and now Williams equal the amount of points in two races that they got in all of last year. And that was three different drivers and many, 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 many more crashes. And even Sainz crash was nowhere near as expensive as any one of those ones. So it's really nice to see, and it's a case of they're in P4. I don't expect it to stay there. But I wouldn't be mad if they did either. I don't know who I've got to sacrifice. I don't want to have to sacrifice Ferrari for it necessarily, but I'm willing to sacrifice someone else up the top of the grid to keep them there. Red Bull
Red
or
Bull, yeah.
McLaren, to be honest.
I think it's going to be Red Bull if any of those teams are the ones that sort of start to stumble. It's going to be Red Bull because of their own blindness. But yeah, Williams look to be in a really sort of good place at the moment. And I'm looking forward to seeing how they develop. And now that Sainz is starting to get his feet under the table, now he's had a proper Grand Prix weekend to work his way through. And again, the sprint is kind of useful in this scenario because it gives him a sort of a second bite in the cherry when it comes to getting the car used to doing a racing start, getting used to sort of jostling in the pack, getting used to circulating it in dirty air. For him, this will have been a very useful weekend. In fifth, then we finally get to Ferrari. Hamilton qualified fifth, Leclerc qualified sixth, both were disqualified. And I don't know how much you've got to say on this one, but I've been doing some sort of digging and sort of figured out and tied down a bit as to why this sort of happened.
It happened because they forgot the fundamentals. You don't go into a basketball game without properly tying your shoes, and yet it's exactly what Ferrari have done here, and they've massively tripped themselves up and gone, how have we managed to do that? They've already done it in Austin in 23. Mercedes did it last year with George in Spa. So it's not just them, but again, this is something where in a season that promises to be as tight as this one, you cannot afford to do something like this, and they may not already be able to afford to do it because it'd be very interesting to see at the end of the year what points differential was like. And it's something that you can say but shouldn't always say of, oh, I can see where they won or lost this championship because it's obviously built over an entire season. At the same time, though, there will be some obvious errors come the end of the season where you can go, yeah, there was no actual need for this one. The only thing I've got to say on this is that, Hamilton's muted and hesitant rather, celebrations during the sprint tells you everything you need to know about the sprint. It's still nice to see him dominate through that and prove that he's still more than capable. I mean, he had, what, a 7 second lead over Piastri by the end of a 19 lap race, rather. That was nice to see, but yeah, it was kind of good. But I'd rather have an actual race win, you know, one that counts on count back.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and I think that there's something there with this car. It's a relatively able performer. Look at what they're able to do in qualifying. Look at the pace they're able to extract of it. But against the rough surface of the relayed track, this was an uphill battle for them. Charles is more used to how that car gets through tyres, so could utilise that one stop. Though still a lot to learn for Lewis on sort of how that car works on aggressive compounds, and doing all that learning and then still coming home as strongly as he did was sound. Their overall actual performance, where they finished on the road, was still pretty good. We can't fault them for that. And then obviously to be disqualified. This is the same problem we had with Russell in Spa most recently, and the weight of the lost rubber on an aggressive tarmac meant that Leclerc was under. The new C2 tyre compound is partly to blame for this. It hadn't been run that weekend on the surface, so even Pirelli didn't really know quite how much of its sort of actual grip-based compound it was going to shed. So the expected degradation was different to the reality, and this means the teams couldn't work backwards from the end goal of the 800 kilogram weight target. Bear in mind that race teams run their race backwards from crossing the finish line, because when in Formula One you cross the finish line, there are certain parameters that that car must meet. It must weigh a certain amount, it must have a certain amount of fluids in it, the driver and the car must weigh this much, yada yada yada, this bit must not be any thinner than this. So teams work backwards from there to figure out the absolute best setup you can do without contravening those parameters. One of those things is weight, one of those things is the depth of the skid block. Skid block one, fairly obvious, but we'll get to that in a second as well. So it's small wonder that they were also asking Charles to stay off the curbs, given that Lewis's penalty and disqualification came from the worn down skid block. So possibly something they were also hesitant for Leclerc to run into the difficulties of as well. And you've got to question the operational side of Ferrari. How did they not know this? How did they not learn from history that this has happened not just to them previously, but also to other teams more recently with the current setup of cars? It is baffling. And the skid block, why was it scraping? Why we'd heard Charles being told to stay off the curbs. They made a setup change between the sprint and the Grand Prix, and this is where a lot of Lewis's perceived drivability came in. And I think what they might have done was change the ride height. And what this does is activates the aero differently, which would be why Charles' missing front wing end plate wasn't so detrimental, but would also be why Lewis Hamilton ran out of skid block. So, as ever, Ferrari has left me asking more questions than they've supplied answers to. So, business as usual in that regard. But at the same time, I'm just sort of left grumbling about it all because it's Ferrari, it should know better.
Got to remember to tie your shoes.
Got to remember to tie your shoes. Meanwhile, a team that did remember to tie their shoes, and this weekend was the highest finishing Ferrari-powered team, and also saw Ocon promoted to the highest scoring Ferrari-powered driver in the championship. It's Haas. Ocon qualified 11th and Behrmann qualified 17th. Ocon would go on to finish 5th and Behrmann 8th. And Ellie Mae made a brilliant point across the weekend. She isn't able to join us due to illness tonight, but she made a brilliant point that Behrmann has scored in all but one of the Grand Prix weekends he's taken part in. So he has a 75% success rate when it comes to these things.
It's just good to see them bounce back after Australia. We gave them a lot of, quite frankly, appropriate shit for it, but this is also potentially a demonstration of the yo-yo effect that we'll see with some of the teams at different venues across the season, which is good because we need that to keep that whole tight battle going on. As Ellie Mae says, really good weekend for Behrmann and more than what he needed after Australia. We're a way to bounce back from him. Ocon channeling his inner George Russell in terms of having an anonymous race with a P5 in the end. I'm sure he won't be complaining that he virtually wasn't seen for the entire time. And Henry, the racing gods listen to you. Whether or not they listen to you for Suzuka, I don't know, but you know, when you're a Haas fan, you take it where you can.
I think the only time Ocon really made it onto camera, he made a few replays with some good overtakes, especially the one where it was sort of a pass in the grass, move to the side on the run down the long back straight was quite phenomenal. And yeah, there's obviously a bit of stability in that Haas that if you can run it half on tarmac, half on grass, and it doesn't decide to try and bite and flip spin you round. really interesting to see. But overall, not too bad from them this weekend. Lovely double point haul. They made the calls work, and Behrmann terrorized the field with some top tier shithousery as well. And yeah, now on the scoreboard. So this, I think, for the team, it's their second best finish, short of K-Mag and Rogro finishing P4 and 5 in Austria. So to all
Rogers
around.
would be glad they've got a good result that's somewhere not in Austria. His voice just seems to be there that they do really well, and then everywhere else you go, maybe.
Yeah, but there we go. It's a great time to be a Haas fan, which is a very rare thing to say about Formula One indeed. We'll move then into Aston Martin, where once again it's sort of lopsided, and strangely so. Alonso qualified 13th and Stroll qualified 14th. That's relatively normal. Then Alonso DNFs, and Stroll finishes in the points P9.
2 weekends in a row, and I have to give Lance Stroll credit. When did I wake up in the Twilight Zone? Is my genuine question for everyone, because what the fuck, quite frankly? It's baffling that he's ahead of Charles Leclerc in Drivers' Championship. It's staggering that Alonso has no points, admittedly through not too much fault of his own. It's just bad luck and car being bad and failing on him because brakes. Kind of essential, didn't have any. It's just a bit bonkers and shows you how topsy-turvy this season is potentially going to be. And I'm kind of curious to see how strong Lance Stroll can do this. I do just remind myself of the frequent Top Gear episodes where James May is replaced by the Stig and it just hasn't been found out yet. And at what point are we going to have a Mission Impossible kind of situation and they pull off Lance Stroll's face and it's just literally anyone else under there? It's kind of Sebastian Vettel the entire time as we wanted it to be originally of him and Alonso being partnered up. But for now, as much as it's weird to say, fair play, Stroll.
Yeah, I mean, Jess Hawkins was in China this weekend. There's every reason
It's
that.
true.
But anyway, yeah, it seems very odd, this consistency they've got. It's sort of the car is there or thereabouts for them. And Lance ran the car for ages on a one stop, and it seemed quite jousty, even when it was getting a bit thin on tires. So they've obviously figured out a bit of it, and it's obviously come to a point that Lance sort of finds it quite drivable. And like you said, in the sprint, he was able to really hold up Norris for quite some time, which is Lando Norris in a very good McLaren at the moment. It's not something you expect. So clearly, there is the dirty air and the fact that you really have to dive bomb to make any overtakes around China. But at the
But
same
it's
time,
still Lance Stroll in
yeah.
Aston Martin. You should be able to get past that pretty damn quickly on any other part of the circuit.
Yeah, so certainly at some point, maybe we're going to have to give Aston Martin and Stroll some kudos with this one. I don't know. We await judgment. We are still skeptical. Alonso's brake failure to me was a bit of a strange one, possibly just a blocked duct from dirt on the track that overheated him early on. It had been a very dirty weekend on the circuit. A lot of concrete dust laid down to mop up a few oil spills. So I can only assume that we may have had some particulates clogging or setting fire to some brake pads in the rear. Anyway, next on the list, strangely enough, is Kik Sauber. Hülkenberg qualified 12th and Borghetto qualified 19th. Nothing unusual there. And then P15 and P14 for the drivers, respectively.
Not much to say on them, but it was good to see Borghetto and Hadjar duking it out a bit in the sprint, continuing their tussle from last year in Formula 2. I did quite enjoy that. Otherwise, a bit of an anomalous race with a pair of them. Did find myself amused at the end of the sprint where I think it was Dylan got tangled up with the two Saubers and then Carlos Sainz, who's about 6 years behind them because of his pit stop, just do-do-do-do-do, drive around the outside, and there's three places in one corner because I'm Carlos Sainz, and that makes sense. And oh, I've just gone up to 17th. No points available for it, but it is just pretty funny when you see how far back he was on the timing screen, and then he's just suddenly 17th.
Yeah.
So not great for Kik Sauber, but it also does kind of feel like normal programming has been resumed for Kik Sauber as they've had their one potentially good race of the year. Hopefully not for their sake, but even if it was, they still outperformed themselves from last year, so it's okay.
Yeah. I think so much went wrong for them this weekend. An abject lack of pace in the dry, I think, is going to be their undoing. They obviously haven't got a very good or very developed chassis. And while we know rain to be the great equalizer in this sport, the problem is when it's not raining, all of a sudden, those gaps open up, and this is, I think, where we're going to have those problems. Nico was in the right place to capitalize on chaos in Melbourne as well, but they were just too far off of it this weekend to make hay while the sun shone, and as such have walked away empty-handed. Meanwhile, when it comes to making mistakes, Racing Bulls, Hadjar qualified 7th, Tsunoda 9th, really strong outing for the two of them in qualifying, and then they finished P11th and P16th, even with the disqualifications ahead of them. And the gamble for a two-stopper just wasn't the way to go, annoyingly, unless they knew that they were going to be underway on tyres, in which case I sort of will give them benefit of the doubt there. But both
I think
drivers.
that's just you looking for reasons at this point because you don't have any actual reasons to present.
There are some straws and I'm clutching at them. Both drivers were running very well, and the raw pace in the car was great. That car does look pretty handy, but through the field after that second stopper, the pace just wasn't there. Should have gambled one of them on a one stopper. Retrospectively, they threw away points here. If you'd gambled one of them on a one stopper, I think it would have been fine. They would have probably been fine and gambled the guy that stopped second to go for the one stopper, which I think would have been Yuki,
Quite
because he.
frankly, it doesn't matter which one you gamble, just gamble with one of them at this point. You've got two drivers. Arguably, you should gamble Hadjar because he's the new kid, and you go risk it. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't matter too much because at least we can justify to Yuki we had to try something a bit radical and we wanted to make sure that you were safe as such. I think Ted summed it up perfectly. He's kind of being the first one on the dance floor and then going, guys, why is no one else coming onto the dance floor? And then you're just looking like a bit of a mug out there. I mean, credit where it's due, they got 3 points in the sprint, which was obviously very much needed. But once again, because you can qualify well, doesn't mean that you're going to be able to then finish in the points. And like you say, I agree, they should have gambled with one of the cars. I mean, Hadjar P11 on that strategy, that close with all the disqualifications. If they'd gambled, they could have got one or 2 points out of it. And when that part of the field is going to be as tight as we think it's going to be, it again potentially going to bite them in the ass, and it's 2 weekends in a row now where we've had messiness across a Grand Prix for very different reasons, but the fact that they've not been able to capitalize on either, despite qualifying well for both, it just goes to show that you can have a decent car with good qualifying pace and good race pace, but it doesn't mean jack shit if you can't actually do anything with it. Yeah, that's why I say keep the driver line up the way it is, because until you can defy your own strategy masters and drag that car into places in the Grand Prix that it doesn't deserve to be normally, a la a Pierre Gasly or Alex Albon or, a Liam Lawson in some respects, then just quieten down and do kind of what Ferrari need to do and focus again on those fundamentals. It's great that you've got two strong drivers in that car, but again, they're not the only ones in that team. Maybe they should be for the strategy. They might want it slightly better for themselves, but who knows?
Yeah, it's just the strategy is letting them down, because it's a car that can, and it's two drivers that are proving very actively that with that car they can. Also, just very unfortunate that Yuki's wing broke while driving in the wake of Carlos Sainz. It was a very strange failure, especially because it happened at what's usually one of the sort of the thicker, sturdier points of the wing. But oh well, I guess that's possibly just a bad cure when it comes to making things. So we've only really got Andy to possibly blame about that one. But we get to the final team in this. Standings, and it is Alpine. Gasly qualified 16th, Doohan qualified 18th. Gasly would later go on to be disqualified, while Doohan would finish P13.
Trouble I have with this. Doohan gets a 10-second penalty for an accident, a genuine accident, because, he's trying something, locks up. He didn't deliberately do what happened, hence the accident. And yet, over in F1 Academy, and I get these are two very different championships, but it's just an interesting compare and contrast there. Chloe Charm takes out three cars and gets the same penalty. It does seem a bit strange because that was admittedly, maybe an accident as well, more of an accident. One of the cars was the same car she'd also taken out the previous day, so I feel like there might just be something else going on later. We'll get to that in a little bit, but it just kind of seemed very harsh. And bear in mind, Doohan already got 2 penalty points on his license for the incident, which again, incident, not deliberate or massively catastrophic crash with Bortoletto in the sprint. And you just think, can someone give Doohan a break, please? He's just doing his best, no pun intended. And he's not a million miles away from Gasly. Give him a break. Stop being so mean to him. P13 again, he could have been on the cusp of points there without that. And after two race weekends, as we talked about earlier, with very little in the way of development to get embedded into this team a bit more, and with the pressure he's got on him, thanks to Alpine not really being publicly supportive. The one thing I kind of can give Red Bull is that at least in the media, they're saying the obvious thing of, well, look at everything, but they're wanting to support Lawson, and they're saying as much. It's already better than what Alpine are doing on that front, so some credit there. He was doing pretty damn well under the circumstances, I think, and this isn't helping him. And you just go, guys, why? Why?
I think this goes back to our previous shared gripes about stewarding and the way that it brings out inconsistent penalties, is the fact that I think they bungled and bundled the penalties with this one. I think they didn't make it clear, or should have made it, or should have appointed the penalties differently, and it should have been, if at all anything, a 5 second penalty for either causing a collision or forcing a driver off the road. But at this point, also, it was forcing Kadra off the track, so it shouldn't really be a full 10 second. I think a 5 would have been fine there, and it would have sort of restored the balance that had been in place by between the drivers. It was just a bit
I
messy.
think that was just nice hard racing, you know. It was kind of, you saw Lawson fighting Bortoleto, I want to say, in the sprint, and rubbing the tire up against him, literally rail overtaking. And I don't think he got anything for that. That was perfectly fine. And he's literally touching the car. You think if you're gonna get into the inconsistency, it's kind of how are you, where are you measuring it, how are you drawing that line? It's frustrating because you think if you're gonna penalize him for that, when there's not even any contact, when there is actual contact, oh, but it wasn't off the track. Oh, well, that's all right, then we'll just do some more wheel bashing. Where it's not a clear set of parameters, it's not consistent enough, and it just frustrates because you go, as a driver, how do you know how aggressive to be? You look at Verstappen, he's incredibly aggressive in a lot of circumstances and is fine with it. But then in other situations, you get a different driver and you get a penalty. You go, but why?
Yeah,
Because
this is.
simulating the world championship.
Yeah, it's one. It's yeah. I think this is definitely more of a gripe with stewarding than it is with Doohan or Alpine. But I mean, Doohan, there was a few messy moments from Doohan as well. But he was definitely getting better. He's getting more at home in the chassis again. Case in point for just simply giving them time, and he's getting racy. He was making some great moves, and it was great watching him back on track. So it was back watching sort of prime him in Formula 2, really making some sense and sort of putting his car where you don't think the car should be put and making it work. It's really exciting. Gasly looked at home and confident, but received nothing for his efforts. The DSQ doesn't impact their points haul, sadly. I think Gasly would have finished outside the points regardless. So same basic issue that hampered Ferrari for Gasly just coming in underweight, I think. So that rounds out our run through of the constructors from the weekend. We'll get into our winners and spinners. Timo, your winner.
Mercedes, because they're just kind of quietly going about their business and no one seems to have noticed, and that's going to become an issue for everyone else if they don't take notice. I don't know what they do once they do take notice, but the fact is you've got George getting two podiums, you've got Antonelli right there, and regardless if it was P6 or P8, he was still doing a very nice job there. And it again feels a little bit like the opening of Jaws. You can hear the music, but you can't quite see the giant shark that's going to screw everything up for you.
I mean, last year it was sort of widely appointed that Red Bull's success when it came to the Constructors' Championship, or no, Max's success when it came to the Drivers' Championship, rather, was because he had that strong early start and just made it tricky for anyone to catch him. McLaren and Mercedes might be able to do something similar when it comes to the Constructors this year. If they have these strong, consistent early starts, they might be too tricky to catch as the season develops. So I agree with you on that one. Ellie May submitted a winner in absentia. She's gone for Piastri, which I think is fair because he had a very clean weekend and
Didn't do anything wrong.
proved exactly why he's there and what he's doing is doing amazingly.
First pole position as well.
Yeah, it's mad that it's taken that long for him to get his first pole, but there we go. It's nice that he was also
And a new lap record around Shanghai. Well, obviously not the new race lap record.
new
He's
qualifying
still the
record.
quickest man to ever go around there, which he seemed nonplussed about, but that's Piastri.
Especially because I think his method for the final sector was quite literally send it. I think that's exactly what he said in an interview post qualifying. Meanwhile, my winner has got their act together, played out a sensible race, a few more of those, and we could have an interesting season for them. Getting the drivers in the right place and ready to capitalize on things as they change is key, and their outright performance is perfect. Behrman might not have been in the points standard, but Ocon was, and just a few little points here and there can make you quite a hurdle for teams behind you. So we'll wait and see how that pans out for them. Meanwhile, when it comes to spinners, you and Ellie may share racing bulls.
Yes, I'm going to presume Ellie May's gone for it for the strategists. I've gone for them for fundamentals and just overall kind of just not being where they need to be. It's kind of you've got half the weekend sorted, but it's the wrong half of the weekend that you would want if you could choose between the two of them. You'd rather have a bad qualifying and finish well rather than qualify well and finish badly. It's, yeah, I saw this with Team Penske and IndyCar. Terrible qualifying. But then two of the drivers managed to get really far up, and you go, nice recovery. You'd rather have it that way around.
Yeah, you'd rather be able to be finishing on the podium rather than sort of being stood there in the paddock at the end of a Saturday going, oh, I've done amazingly, and then all of a sudden sort of arse end of nowhere in the grid. For me, my spinner, I think, sort of got two. As annoying as the Ferrari failure is, it was something that they were unluckiest to suffer from and highlights how much of a gamble they, and to an extent, other teams are taking to win races, the mathematics and the technicality that goes into it. But for me, Liam Lawson does need to start performing a bit more visibly. And if we're calling him a rookie, which we seem to be broadly accepting he is, this counts more as a sort of, I want you to do better. I expect more from you. I wish you the best, as we often do for the feeder series episodes when we're talking about younger drivers and rookies and people making the step ups. I want him to have some success because I want that seems to be the only thing that Red Bull really seems to give a hoot about. And for Red Bull to give him that fair chance, he needs to have a little bit of success early on. So if he can bang in a top six finish in Suzuka, that is sort of what I could do. I really want to see from him because I think that will immediately take the pressure off and give him that chance just to sort of properly settle down. If you look at what all the other sort of rookies have had, they've had, with the exception of Doohan and Bortoletto, they've had relatively strong opening gambits. Hadjar, ignoring Australia, has proven he's got great qualifying pace and really good racecraft and race pace. You look at what Antonelli's done, which has just proved that he is Mr. Consistency, putting his billions of testing kilometers to the practice. You look at sort of what Bortoletto's done as well, which is proving he's got great qualifying pace, but the car is dog. So you look at what they're all doing. They've had these opportunities to prove themselves with respect to the cars they're in. Lawson hasn't had a fair opportunity to do that yet, and I would like for that opportunity to come. So I feel that is why I sort of wanted to honorifically give
Again,
him.
feels like more Red Bull is the spinner in the same way that Racing Bulls is Ellie Mays. It's kind of she's chosen the team rather than the drivers.
Perhaps I'll rephrase it. Maybe it is Red Bull that is the spinner here because they haven't been sort of giving Lawson that opportunity to honorifically have a success of some sort, but it focuses around Lawson. Anyway, predictions review: no points for pole position. Timo gets one when it came to predicting the podium for the Piastri win, and Ellie May gets one for her wild prediction, which I can't remember how wild it was. It
Rookies
was
finish the race.
every rookie finishes, yeah, which.
And I was annoyingly close to getting mine. I needed one more rookie in the top 10. I got two, and I needed three. And I just, again, Hadjar, I should have maybe that's why I put Racing Bulls as my spinner because he annoyed me there. Because it's like, could have just been a little bit closer, then split the strategy. I could have had another point in the predictions review.
Yeah, you also
But
needed.
Racing Bulls sort your stuff out.
You had three rookies in the top 10 plus Alonso written in as well. So
I
I think.
said, plus Alonso, as in that includes him as a rookie.
Yeah. But obviously, Alonso
Doesn't need.
left, so he wouldn't have been in the top 10.
No, but only need
Oh,
to
so you
be
only needed
rookies in
three.
the
Okay,
top
you only
10.
need. I thought you needed. Okay, so Alonso counted as
No,
one of
no.
the rookies to pick
Alonso
for.
is a rookie, so therefore, if he'd finished in the top 10, he would have helped
Forgot
me win
about
that.
that. Not three rookies and then Alonso. It was
No,
Alonso.
no.
Could be any one of those three
It's a
rookies.
wildly specific world prediction, otherwise, that three rookies and just some other random driver need to finish in the top 10. I'm not that mad just yet.
I'm back on your thought train. Meanwhile, my wild prediction was double V card points, which genuinely seemed like it could have come true at some point, but it didn't. So I'm very annoyed with them too. Meanwhile, fantasy F1 review for China team for Elias den RB fan. I'm assuming German or
I
Dutch.
think that's the one that you were confused about last week is now clarified what its name is. All those random letters, I think that's the team that was, it seems similar in the opening letters.
Possibly,
I
possibly
just forgot to actually
put them
type out what all of the words and letters meant.
together.
I've not seen it elsewhere.
There's Jalogish. What was it? Deiticulus and we've got a lot of Europeans seem to have entered the competition this year,
Good.
which baffles me. But they are very welcome. I hope they're enjoying playing in our fantasy league. And yes, I believe quite possibly that is the one that has renamed itself. Yes, so Team Ferrelias, then RB Fan, 281 points. Der Tiklias, 269 points, and Jarogish, 257 points. I apologize if I've absolutely mangled the pronunciations of your fantasy Formula One team names. Meanwhile, when it comes to our results, Can't Grow a Moustache, P5, Hopeful Heroes, P9, On the Curbs, P23, and Got That Dog in P49. Overall, Jalogish 444 points, Lando 419 points, and Big Reach 407. Big Reach, is that my girlfriend's word?
Yes, it is.
Oh, well, she's doing very well so far. Nice.
Beating you.
Well, it's not hard. Can't Grow a Moustache in fourth overall, which isn't too bad. Hopeful Heroes. Yes, my Hopeful Heroes. Antonelli, Ocon, Albon, Behrman, and Doohan. Clearly a good little lineup, currently in seventh. I will say I do notice that you don't have a team in the top 10 at the moment.
No, it's not gone well so
In
far.
fact,
I've
you're
It was
absolutely
going well up until the disqualification. I had Hamilton on double points and Ferrari in one of my teams.
you're
And
absolutely in the
obviously
top
that's
30.
I'm lulling you all into a false sense of security.
Top 35. We get to 36, and there we go, on the curbs.
Like I said, false sense of security. But I'm still, what is it, at least 2 points ahead of you in the predictions, so
Yeah,
it's
that
all
sense of
going quite well.
security is very false. Anyway, there we go. Feeder Series Corner. Obviously, we had Formula One Academy back for its first race weekend this season, and Meyer Werg took pole with Nina Gaydman on reverse pole because they've been sensible and they've said, look, if we're going to have a first shorter race, we'll have a reverse grid for it. Palmowski, Chambers, and Virg podium for race one. Virg really doing nicely to come through the field there. Chambers having a fantastic race, and Palmowski just sort of capitalizing on the unfortunate mechanical failure for Nina Gaydman. And then for race two, it was Pan Virg and Chambers on the podium. So again, some familiar faces from last season, and certainly three of the tidiest drivers that we've got available to us. Pan and Virg, certainly my big carryovers from last season. It's great to see Chambers stepping up so nicely as well, really pushing it. Alba Larson, though, properly special little talent, watching what she's able to do in some absolutely mad lad sends. Yeah, clearly
It was her and Ferreira who were the two drivers, and Lloyd actually, that were the three newbies as such, with Palmoski, I suppose, as well there. Consistently in the points for both races in those high positions. It was really nice to see that because again you've got Larson, like you say, who's again looks like a child elf from Lord of the Rings, and I mean that in a complimentary way. It's just what she reminded me of. And then you've got Palmoski, who that one race that she should have had two races in Qatar last year, coming in and going, I really hate Lloyd. Terrible qualifying, made up for it in the race. Look at that, racing balls. And Ferreira, really nice job there. And I know that the grandstand will have been majoritively packed because of Formula One, but it's the most packed I've ever seen grandstands for F1 Academy. And I quite like that because it's never a given. You see F2 and F3, even on sprint race weekends in other places for Formula One, where F1 Academy also there, and it doesn't quite have the same attendance, and it's a real shame. So I was quite happy to see that there. And as I mentioned earlier with my LP point, I don't know if it's baked into contract of whoever drives for Charlotte Tilbury, but violence seems to be on the agenda for whichever driver goes for them. Logan Foss had the honours last year, and we saw how that went. Chloe Trunk starting off with taking out poor Nicole Hovda twice, and then another two drivers at the same time in the second race. And not how you want to start off that one, is it really? But we can discuss all of that in a separate podcast. So I just thought I'd make note of that. I think that's something to keep an eye on because makeup and violence. It's maybe a John Wick potential crossover with a new film coming out later in the year.
Yeah, it's some unfortunate and interesting starts to the Formula One Academy. Certainly, if you look at how Prema were trying to, I won't say coach, but advise Tina Housman and Nina Gaveman when it came to their race start for the second race when the grids were set
Didn't
back.
work for Tina, did it?
Did not work. She made a very all clumsy send, and I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that post-race debrief.
Well, if you heard the team radio, that was enough there because you could tell Prema tr trying to pour some coolant on that fire and instead got it mixed up with oil and petrol, whereas Nina had clearly seen everything and decided to point it out to them immediately, which quite likes because fair enough, why wouldn't you in that situation? Your teammate's just done the one thing she's been specifically told not to do, and you have done
Absolutely
nothing wrong up to that point.
but yeah, Alba Harrop Larsson, she's coached by Kevin
Paymag.
Magnussen. Yeah, and again, great to see the sort of him taking an active role in supporting the next generation through, and also clearly working. She's got an aggressive set of driving mitts on her, and looking forward to the sort of the chaos she might cause as the season rolls on. Unfortunate series of outings for her as the wild card, though, I think it has to be
The
said.
wild card either does really well or really doesn't. There is no middle ground.
No middle ground. Yeah, you're either a Palmowski or you're an unfortunate, in this case, Xi Wei, when it comes to sort of the wild card nature in F1 Academy. But otherwise, that is all we've got time for on what I feel has been yet another long race review. We'll be back
Blame
in.
Red Bull.
Yeah, blame Red Bull for that one. We should definitely have a separate episode, or perhaps cut it out and release that as a separate chunk. Anyway, we'll be back in next week with a preview for the Japanese Grand Prix. In the meantime, though, Timo, where can the listeners find you if they want some more of your work?
You can find me over on Everything F1, where I've got a Key Takeaways article out on IndyCar's latest round at the Thermal Club, and if anyone is actually capable of beating Alex Palou, it doesn't look likely. And later in the week, there'll be a piece out on Eddie Jack.
Have you also mentioned the Devlin G. Francesco argument that was started in the paddock afterwards as well with what's it?
Scott McLaughlin, yes, that is going to be talked about in an episode of On the Clips City coming out later in the week as to how he's blaming Scott McLaughlin for something he did and got a penalty for. Quite amusing.
You can see Scott McLaughlin with a giant shit-eating grin going, "You did that. You drove into me and you got a penalty for it. You got a drive-through for that. How are you coming at me telling me
And
that?"
happily waiting to be shown the footage so he can point it out to him
Yeah.
again.
Yeah. I did see a great tweet was IndyCar looking to bring in a balance of power style setup for their drivers, the same way that WEC has, and the image attached to it was simply a step stool because there's the physical image of a relatively tall Scotty Mac and a relatively short Devlin DeFrancesco sort of. Literally, the shot is so obvious because they're wearing peaked caps, so you can see the angle at which one is looking up and the other is looking down.
I'm waiting for Yuki to annoy Ben, not Ben, sorry, Ocon or Hülkenberg for us to get the same version of it in F1.
It's going to be funny. Anyway, that's your incentive to go and watch IndyCar this season, even if it is going to be an Alex Palou domination. There are other bits worth watching in that. Anyway, that's all. Oh, if you want more from me, pick up the latest issue of Classic Car Weekly. Look us up on our social media channels. We do a lot of YouTube and podcasting now, but obviously the paper product is the important thing. Give it a read. In our latest one, I'm driving a 1995 MGF, and we've got all of our live coverage from the restoration show at the NEC. So plenty to be enjoyed from there. Otherwise, we'll be back with a preview of the Japanese podcast. My brain has melted. We've got a preview podcast of the Japanese Grand Prix. There we go. Coming up next week. So we'll go and collate some news and put together some thoughts and predictions. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back soon.